In the news.
Good morning, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Government.
You're in our cocoon of warmth, where everything is safe and secure. You can say whatever you want. Well, actually, you can't say anything because, you know, we're not really listening. But we'll talk to you, and we will feel your vibes vicariously. So, welcome. What are we, week two now? We had one in the news.
Yep.
Got three more after this, so we're kind of midstream here. We're kind of like baseball. We're got our all-star break. We're moving towards the first exam, which is when? No. It's like this week?
Yeah.
Okay.
Soon and very soon.
We'll be on that. Thanks to many of you who've communicated with Professor McDaniel and myself. We need to hear about some of the issues and situations that you've got early in the class. There haven't been a ton of those, but a few people have contacted us, and you know, we encourage that. I mean, don't sit at home with, you know, problems or, you know, qualms with the class. Come and talk to us, and if we can't help you, we can certainly put you in touch with either the tech people or the TAs or the appropriate people to kind of get stuff going. Because it's tough in a class like this, and where, you know, you have a lot of content but not a lot of personal contact. So we'd encourage you to go ahead and do that, especially when you need something. But also, Professor McDaniel and I will be holding, I'll have in-person office hours. Professor McDaniel will have a lot of virtual office hours over the semester. So take advantage of that. You know, we're here for you.
That's right.
Not so much emotionally, but, you know, intellectually.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. All right. So what we got this week?
So quite a bit's been going on. So we've been talking about the healthcare vote in the Senate. So again, it was a pretty big fight to get it out of the House. Now it's moved to the Senate. And it looks like it's going to die in the Senate. It was there was going to be a vote, then it was delayed because Senator John McCain had to have surgery. Now you've had four Republicans basically say they're not going to support it. Two you consider to be kind of the hardline conservatives, one moderate and one kind of middle of the pack. So it looks like for right now, the healthcare bill, the attempt to overhaul or replace the ACA is done for now. Now, again, there are statements of like, no, it'll come back. However, a lot of political capital has been spent on this, and it's going to be very interesting to see what's happened. The public has already riled up and made their statement like, look, this is what we want. You've had governors on both the left and the right being upset about this and really people seeing this as an attack on Medicaid. So it's really interesting to see if anything can be salvaged from this as, you know, as Congress gets ready for recess. It'd be interesting what happens when they come back and reconvene next year.
Yeah. Well, a couple things. Let's get down into the weeds a little bit with this, because this is the major public policy issue that's facing the current Congress. There are other things going on. There are questions involving security and immigration and tax reform. But really, reforming the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, has been front and center. It was a critical Republican promise in 2014 when they retook the Senate. It was a critical part of Trump's campaign. So with the Republicans have the presidency, the House, and the Congress, and, you know, a functioning majority, or at least something close to majority, on the Supreme Court, can they actually fulfill one of their major campaign promises? So as Professor McDaniel suggested, and we talked about last week, there's pressure on the right. These are Republicans who want to completely just blow out Obamacare and, you know, start from scratch. They don't want to tinker with it. They want to do away with it. And then there are others. Olympia Snowe is an obvious one, but there are other Republicans and a lot of these governors, especially we're listening to people like Senator Portman from Ohio and John Kasich, Governor Kasich of Ohio, have said, you know, they're not the fire-breathing conservatives who want to do away with it. They're concerned about the federal government yanking, or the, you know, in a new deal, if they repeal Obamacare, the federal government yanking subsidies for the expansion of Medicaid, which was critical to increasing coverage. Right. So we talked a little about that last week, but Professor McDaniel, I think, correctly pointed out, there's a little bit of a revolt amongst these governors, Republican and Democratic, but the governors, because what Obamacare did was the federal government came in and said, we're going to insure more people, we're going to expand Medicaid, so the people who couldn't previously qualify for it but are, you know, right at the poverty line or have real trouble paying for their own health insurance, we're going to help them get that. To do that, the federal government's going to give money to the states to expand this coverage. Some states said, no, we don't want to do that. Texas, for instance, said no, and Texas's reasoning was, The federal government has only promised this money for X period of time. We think the federal government's going to yank that money away from us, and then we, the state of Texas, going to be responsible for it. That was Texas's justification, right? Sort of paranoia about the federal government's commitment to this. Now, sometimes paranoia is justified, but that was the paranoia, right? A lot of other states, Ohio did this, California, New York, et cetera, they accepted the terms. They said, we'll go ahead and expand this, the Medicaid system. We will accept the federal money. Those are the states and the governors of those states who are really mad right now because they say, well, look, you guys, we put ourselves out on the line. We expanded Medicaid. And now it's not the federal government simply running out of money. It's a political decision to reform this thing in a way that we're going to have to take away a benefit that we granted to our people.
And benefits are very difficult to take away. That's why Social Security, Medicare cannot be touched. So once you provide certain benefits, you know, if you think of subsidies, things of that nature, it's very hard to take them away. Once you give a benefit, it's very difficult to take away. And one of the things that's been being covered quite a bit in the press is how the Medicaid expansion has actually improved healthcare in the West, at least access to healthcare in many of the Western states that are very rural. And they've been able to set up a new infrastructure, and that by reducing Medicaid, that would harm this infrastructure. So now, again, what's important to note here is that access to health insurance or having health insurance does not necessarily mean people will be healthier. Health insurance is supposed to increase access with the idea that increased access will lead to increased health. Specifically, that increased access will prevent will help in terms of preventing certain illnesses or help people control certain chronic illnesses. So if you think of someone who's able to regularly visit their doctor, they're able to take care of something, a chronic illness such as diabetes. And one of the things that the U.S. suffers from, one of the big problems the U.S. has, is treating chronic illnesses. So one, preventing chronic illnesses and then treating chronic illnesses. And so in many cases, things that can be easily prevented or treated kind of spiral out of control and you end up in a crisis. And so many other nations are very good at preventing chronic and treating chronic illnesses. However, they're not as good as when it comes to crisis. The U.S. is great when it comes to crisis, but very poor at preventing crisis. And so it's kind of this trade-off. And again, one of the key aspects of this is financing health. And this is where it becomes very complicated. And that's where you have a number of people involved. You have third-party payers, things of that nature. And that's what many people argue for a single-payer system, because a single-payer system really simplifies how we're going to finance health. However, that's really been pushed back, very strong pushback against that. And so as you read through this and you try to understand like what all is going on, it's very important to understand this is all about financing healthcare, and that by financing healthcare, you can increase access, with the hope being that increasing access will increase positive health outcomes.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Professor McDaniel's done a nice job of laying out the policy implications. And one of the reasons we're attracted to this, not only is it a dominant issue in the news, and we like Russia as much as the next guy, but this is actually a important public policy issue facing the United States. It has these substantial policy implications, as Professor McDaniel's laid out, but it's also a real interesting issue politically. And one of the things, I'll close with this, you know, the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, seems to be, at least if I'm reading the tea leaves and some of the conversations on the Sunday shows correctly, seems to be of the opinion now that he doesn't necessarily need to have a deal on healthcare. In fact, that if it blows up and there is no Senate bill, there's no reconciliation bill between the Senate and the House, and the Republicans aren't going to reform Obamacare, McConnell is now apparently kind of leaning towards doing nothing. And the reasoning is that he thinks if the Republicans do nothing, then the Democrats still own healthcare. That is, they own Obamacare and its implications. And many Republicans, McConnell apparently is one of them, think that Obamacare is going to have a funding crisis that will maybe even send it into what journalists hyperbolically call a death spiral. And that is to say that, you know, right now the federal government is subsidizing some of these statewide exchanges. They're subsidizing the pharmaceutical companies and some of the health insurance companies to ease the transition to Obamacare, a system that's dependent on exchanges, expanded Medicaid, et cetera. These subsidies have been critical to keeping a lot of players in the system. Health insurance companies that are losing money, they're okay because the federal government's offsetting some of those costs. The subsidies are set to expire, however, and they're set to expire before the 2018 midterm elections. So what McConnell is thinking, apparently, is that, okay, this is bad, but if we don't get a deal and Obamacare is simply left out there, that you're going to start to see, as these subsidies go away, a death spiral begin. Or at least what will happen is, to stay in the game, insurance companies will jack up their premiums, jack up their co-pays, and that voters will feel this in advance of 2018. They'll blame the Democrats and Obamacare, and the Republicans will be okay. It's an interesting take. It may be whistling past the graveyard. My two cents worth is that, you know, if you control the entire keys of government, if you control both the House, the Senate, as well as the presidency, and you can't deliver on one of your fundamental campaign pledges, that's just not good. Public policy aside, politically, that suggests you're not doing a very good job. And that never seems to work out for midterm things. So I'm, you know, I like a good story. McConnell seems to be working on a good story, a way to frame what can't otherwise be characterized anything other than kind of a disastrous attempt to reform Obamacare. But, you know, who knows? These guys are much smarter than I am. Not Professor McDaniel, mind you, but much smarter than I am. So we'll see how it goes. But anyway, it seems to be that the Republicans are laying the groundwork, at least Senate Republicans are laying the groundwork for, yeah, we didn't get a deal, but that's okay. Obamacare is a disaster, and the American public will figure that out, and they will punish the Democrats for it. We'll see. That's kind of a bank shot, right? You got to be right about it failing, and you got to be right about attribution of blame. And we'll see if that pans out.
Yeah, I guess one last point that's very important is there's been some work regarding gridlock. And this is clearly a sign of gridlock where D.C.'s not able to get, Washington's not able to get anything done. And people always say, well, when you have divided government, that's when you have gridlock. But really, we have unified government right now, and we still have gridlock. And the key thing here is gridlock is the norm. And so gridlock is the norm, even when you have unified or divided government. And non-gridlock is the unique thing. And so it's very important to pay attention to this, that even if both parties control the House, the Senate, I mean, even if one party controls the House, Senate, and the presidency, you're still going to have gridlock. And so this is important to be aware of as we talk about really the relationships between Congress and the presidency and really the relationship between the House and the Senate.
Yeah, we'll talk about divided government versus unified government later in the semester, but Professor McDaniel just had a key definition. Unified government is when one party has both houses of Congress and the White House. That's unified. Anything else is divided government, and our theoretical expectation is that if there's divided government because of checks and balances and separation of powers, you will have the potential for gridlock. That is, no public policy gets passed, at least without substantial compromise. We seem to have gridlock with unified government, so maybe divided government isn't as big a deal. Maybe there are other factors involved, and that's something we'll talk about later in the semester. Okay, so what else do we got? What we got?
So again,
ooh, Trump Jr.
Yeah, talk about Russia because, hey, why? I mean, we could talk about Beyonce's twins. But so the news come out that Donald Trump Jr. met with several individuals linked to Russia because they had supposedly had incriminating evidence on Hillary Clinton. People are kind of up in arms about this. From what I can tell, there's nothing illegal about what was done. Now, you may say this is a little bit unethical. It may say may look a little sketchy, but there's no sign of any of this being illegal. And so we're kind of stuck with yes, it looks like they tried to work with the Russians to win the election, but here it seems to be get information. And I mean, Donald Trump has defended like, oh, it's politics. This is what we do. You know, and so people have argued that if you say you're going to drain the swamp, it looks like you got pretty deep into the swamp. So, I don't know. To me, it's kind of like, okay, all right, just come to me until you got something interesting. I was actually talking to someone who's high up in the National Press Club about this. He's like, look, it's probably what's going on is really going to be a slow drip. And I guess with Watergate just didn't blow up overnight. It took a while for us to really figure out what's going on. So it seems to be a lot of things going on. And it seems to be, yes, there was an attempt to get information with the Russians, maybe even collude with them. But to what extent, you know, I think for the most part, people might be hit with perjury charges. But to the fact that they actually engaged in something illegal, that is still up in the air.
This is just a weird, weird deal. I mean, so to reset this, the Donald Trump Jr. story runs roughly as follows. Donald Trump Jr. was part of his father's campaign. He was contacted via a third party saying, hey, you should talk with this person with the Russian government who has ties with the Russian government. They may have some dirt on Hillary. So at this point, Trump Jr. says this email exchange, and they set up a meeting where the sort of inducement to the meeting is we might have some information that, you know, it's going to make Hillary look bad. So he takes the meeting. As well as I think Steve Bannon was there, yeah. A couple of their higher ups in the Trump. They had this meeting with this woman who's straight out of a Bond movie. I swear she was in GoldenEye. So she's, you know, looks like, you know, Ivana Humpalot or whoever the character is from Russia with Love. You know, they meet with her, and it turns out she doesn't really have any information, you know, on Hillary. And so she begins talking about the Russian orphanage problem back in 2016 as retaliation for some things the Americans were doing, some sanctions the Americans had slapped on the Russians after Ukraine. The Russians had basically stopped all of the orphanage, the adoption programs from Russia to the United States for Russian children. And so they ended up talking about that. The meeting itself nor the alleged information was not reported to the FBI. As Professor McDaniel says, you know, it's weird in the following way. Is it treason to meet with the Russians? A Russian woman who says, I have information from the Russian government about Hillary Clinton. I don't know. It's kind of, you know, treason seems to me kind of rises to a much higher than treason. Is it the kind of thing you do in campaigns? I've been in a few campaigns, and my sort of personal opinion is you don't take that meeting. You just don't take the meeting. You sort of put them off, and you know, and you probably report that to the FBI. But the notion that the Trump campaign was not a conventional campaign is hardly new. And I guess I'm with Professor McDaniel on this too. If the other shoe that falls would be, okay, and then this information was passed on to Trump, and then Trump used it, or this information... But apparently, they didn't really have any other information. So they took a meeting, you know, someone dangled a little bit, hey, we got some dirt on Hillary. You take the meeting with this sort of questionable foreign source, and then nothing comes of it. I don't know. I mean, unless that information actually was in play and it came about through other sources, and as Professor, you know, maybe that happens. Maybe we learn about that in a few months. But at any rate, those are sort of the circumstances of the Trump Jr. meeting. Now, I will say this, having poo-pooed, you know, I don't really particularly care too much about the substance. Man, do they act like they're guilty. They deny, oh, I never took the meeting. You know, we don't know what you're talking about. And they say, well, I took the meeting. But it was about Russian orphanages. All right. Well, actually, as it turns out, it wasn't just about Russian orphanages. The reason I took the meeting was because it was about dirt on Hillary. You know, stop acting guilty and maybe people won't think you're guilty.
Yeah. I mean, that's the worst part about it is, you know, the cover-up is usually worse than...
Like I tell my kids, it's not the crime, baby, it's the cover-up.
Yeah, yeah, so...
I'm not happy you're eating chocolate in bed. Just don't lie about eating chocolate. By the way, our crack production staff here seem to be much more interested in the Beyonce story than the Trump Jr. story, so...
Yeah.
So maybe we'll get that or put it off till next week.
Yeah, I just gotta remember what the kids' names are. They ain't mine, so I don't really care.
Rumpelstiltskin, I believe. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Okay, so we got a couple of more localized or kind of, not funsy stories. They're certainly stories that, you know, important for the people involved. But we'll go with first. We got two kind of potpourri stories. One is the Airbnb story. The other is the student loan story. What do you want to go with first?
So we'll start with student loans.
Student loans. All
right. I think that hits closest to home.
That's nice.
So... Right now, there is the potential for about close to $5 billion or at least $5 billion in loans to be forgiven. So of student debt and loan forgiveness from private loan companies. And one of the things about private loan companies is that they usually give the loans at a higher interest rate than government loans. Also, they've been pointed to as being much more predatory, and they've been linked to the for-profit colleges. And so there has been a lot of pushback against them in regards to their lending practices, but then also their collection practices. So they're extremely aggressive in terms of collecting their funding. And so a lot of people have been taken to court over this as these industries have tried to get their money back from people they've given loans to. However, many of these cases have been thrown out over one particular issue, bad paperwork. And the bad paperwork is really, there's no clear understanding who actually owns the loan. And so because they cannot establish the owner of the loan, many of these loans have been forgiven. And there's a fear that right now about $5 billion worth of loans will be forgiven because the paperwork was done horribly. So the New York Times reports that the troubled loans, which total at least $5 billion, are at the center of a protracted legal dispute between the student borrowers and a group of creditors who have aggressively pursued them in court after they fell behind on payments. So judges have already dismissed dozens of lawsuits from against former students, essentially wiping out their debt because documents proving who owns the loans are missing. And so this is really a big issue here. Really bad paperwork is going to crumble this industry. Now, many people have said this is very similar to the subprime mortgage crisis that happened really about 2008.
The Big Short. If you haven't seen it, see it.
And so they're saying basically they're very predatory, things of that nature. And so they're going after people and getting, and basically people are like, I can't pay it. So you can't get blood from a rock, or was it blood from a turnip or water from a rock? I don't know.
It's blood from a turnip.
Blood from a turnip, water from a rock.
There you go.
Either way, if a rock is bleeding, I'm leaving. Okay, so. Rock
doesn't bleed.
That's right. So the key thing about it is, you know, this is really one of those major issues where it's really being settled in the courts, and you're seeing that the way the laws are created are actually protecting the students and providing some pushback against what many people paint as predatory lenders. And also this is somewhat of a pushback against the for-profit colleges, which have faced a great deal of scrutiny over the past, I would say, several years.
Yeah, I'll just say that, you know, this was an issue that some of you guys might remember from the 2016 campaign that Bernie Sanders raised in a forceful way that really hadn't been raised by national or prominent political figures before, this issue of student loans. And it's an issue that faces, I mean, somewhat faced my generation, faced Professor McDaniel's generation a little more forcefully, and you guys, I'm sure many of you are quite familiar with this notion that you're going to get out of college, or certainly if you make it to graduate school, you get through graduate school, you're going to have these, you know, sort of massive debts that you're going to have to pay. And it's frightening, it's an important and I think underappreciated and not well understood kind of aspect of the personal economy that exists, you know, heading into the 2020s. And this is an interesting story because it suggests that, you know, these consolidated debt organizations that go after, try to collect these loans, that they're dealing with many different entities. They sort of, they're umbrella organizations that deal with all sorts of different loan organizations. And when they've tried to actually prove in court the nature and magnitude of these loans they've put out for individuals, they don't actually have the paperwork, right? So now, this is why class action suits are such a big deal. You personally may not have the wherewithal to pursue a case against some loan organization if they come at you in an aggressive way, but in these class action suits, many, many different individuals who have been targeted get together, you know, they sort of consolidate all the lawyers' fees and protect themselves against these predatory organizations. And these predatory organizations, it turns out in some of these cases, actually don't have the paperwork to go after the people they've been going after. So if you're asking, so what should my reaction be, you know, you as a student? I don't know. I mean, I don't know that you should be relieved that, you know, gosh, maybe I won't have to pay my debt because I'll screw up the paperwork. I don't think that's the takeaway point. I think the takeaway point is that there clearly needs to be some accommodation or coming to grips with the nature of all these different loan entities that are out there and these unbelievable interest rates that they're charging. I mean, you know, God, come to Professor McDaniel and me for a loan or something. God, don't pay 28% interest on some of these student loans, for God's sake. So, anyway.
Well, the key thing about this is a specific subset of loans. So these are not the loans that are guaranteed by or protected by the federal government.
Right.
So these are outside
these
of
these aren't Pell grants or, you know, none of that kind of stuff.
So these are actually coming out of from private companies, which the federal government has nothing to do with. So there are a lot of loans that you can get from your bank, which the federal government guarantees, and so there are certain restrictions put on those loans. But these private loans, really there are no government restrictions put on them, and so because of that, they can behave they can charge a much higher interest rate, and they can behave in a much different manner.
The government's beginning to get these guys in their crosshairs, though. They're really looking at these things, and it's, you know, an area that is ripe for more substantial regulation than currently exists.
And, okay. And this is a perfect example of why people complain about regulation, but here's an example of why people call for regulation. Is because sometimes businesses say, no, we can regulate ourselves. We trust us. We know what we're doing. But then things like this happen, and people are like, no, I don't think you can. And so it's really this issue of how much freedom do we give the businesses to basically innovate and do things, but, you know, when do we know they're going too far?
Speaking of regulation.
That's right.
Our last story is about Airbnb, which, as many of you all probably know, is an organization that makes housing or provides a platform for people to make their houses available for people to rent out for a few days, usually vacation homes, things like that. You ever done Airbnb?
No, never done. But I know people rave about it.
We did VRBO up near Yellowstone last year. So we were in, what was that little town? Grand Isle or Great Isle or something like that, off of West Yellowstone. Big old house, had a couple families there. It was great. Well, as it turns out, might not have been so great had we been Asian American. Story coming out of, it's actually coming from a couple of different places. The most recent kind of iteration of the story or expression of the story is from California near Big Bear. I'm from Southern California originally, so I know where Big Bear is, up in the mountains, a little east of Los Angeles. Nice area, big old lake, Lake Arrowhead. Well, it turns out an owner of an Airbnb place had a contract out for an Asian family. They were going to rent a place up there in the mountains. The Asian family had asked for a particular accommodation. They wanted an extra family and then like a dog or something like that as part of the agreement. And initially, I believe it was accepted, but then the owner got back to them and said, no, I've changed my mind. You're not going to do that. And sent, so we say, a racially insensitive explanation.
Yeah, I think we actually have video explaining that.
Yeah, yeah. Can we go to that?
The four of us made a reservation on Airbnb about a month ago, and I asked the woman who's the host if two more friends would be okay. I made a reservation for two of us, and I asked if two friends were okay. She said that's fine, we just have to pay more money. So we're driving up, we think everything's fine, we're ready for this ski trip in Big Bear. There were flash flood warnings all day. I asked the woman again, is it okay that my two friends come, right? Like, could we give you cash, or how much did you say it was again? And she says, absolutely not. And I say, but you said yes. Here are some screenshots of text messages where you said that I could bring my friends. And she says, you must be high if you think that that would be okay in the busiest weekend in Big Bear. And then she said, no, like, we're done. And she canceled the trip. And she said, one word says it all, Asian. And, she said, this is why we have Trump. And she said, like, we can't have foreigners telling us what to do. She said that to me. I'm an American citizen. This is my home. I've been here since I was 3 years old. America is my home. I consider myself an American. But this woman discriminates against me for being Asian. She canceled on us when we were 3 minutes away from the house. We're 3 minutes away. I just feel so hurt. Like, I mean, people thought, oh, with the election of President Obama, like, racism is over in this country. No, it's very much alive. It exists, and it could happen to anyone. There's no bounds to racism, no matter what class you are, no matter what your education level, no matter if you're an American citizen. What they see is that I'm Asian. What they see is my race. And this is how we get treated. It stings. It stings that after living in the U.S. for over 23 years, this is what happens. No matter, like, if I follow the law, if I'm kind to people, no matter, like, how well I treat others, it doesn't matter. It's, if you're Asian, you're less than human. And people can treat you like trash.
All right, so that is kind of a firsthand account of what happened. The woman that owned the house, she was fined $5,000. She was also removed from Airbnb, so she can no longer work with Airbnb to rent out her place. But there's one additional aspect to this that really caught the media's attention. As Professor Shaw, you want to talk about that part?
Well, it says that an Airbnb host has been fined $5,000 for racial discrimination and will have to take a course in Asian American studies, which, you know, I think is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
The other thing that I thought was kind of interesting about this also, we'll talk about this kind of broadly here in a second, but the first time an Airbnb host has been penalized after California regulators passed an agreement that allows officials to test Airbnb hosts for racial discrimination. So this is very interesting. Now, that singular episode, which I think kind of dovetails with, you know, we've talked a lot about race and civil rights and discrimination, civil liberties and civil rights and things. That's kind of a core point of the first set of modules that we've passed out in this class. But this kind of dovetails with some of the things we've talked about, which is the federal government, and in this case, not the federal government, misspoke, the state government has gotten involved. But Airbnb, Lyft, Uber, VRBO, this is kind of an interesting thing. The new economy, where there are these sort of clearinghouse organizations that serve as platforms for people to provide person-to-person services, right? That's what Uber is, that's what Lyft is, that's what Airbnb, they basically kind of serve as a way, a meeting place, and allow these kind of new economic entities to form. Well, there's a downside to that. What if your Uber driver is a racist and won't pick somebody up? What if your VRBO or Airbnb host is a racist? To what extent are you as a company responsible for that behavior, fiscally, yeah, dollar-wise, responsible for those behaviors? And the other aspect of it, very related, the state's obligation and sense of involvement here. So we've seen this in Austin with Lyft and Uber about the city of Austin trying to get in and saying, well, wait, you just can't operate here. Your drivers have to be, you know, subject to a criminal criminal background test. And, you know, Uber says, well, we don't want to do that. And so, you know, the state of Texas had to get in because of this patchwork quilt of regulations emerging at the city level to try to regulate what's going on. That's what California has done right here. So California actually says that they have a racial discrimination test for their Airbnb hosts, which is, I think, fascinating. I should have looked up the test before I came in. It'd be kind of interesting to see what exactly they're responsible for. But, you know, I mean, on the one hand, you could look at it and say, well, wait a sec. I mean, what's if somebody has got a house and they don't want to rent to certain people, you know, isn't that their business? Well, in fact, no. As we've seen recently in some of the cases involving, bakers and cakes and gay weddings. Mm-hmm. I mean, this stuff is really, all of this stuff, this sort of nexus of private enterprise, you know, but it's in the public realm and the states want to regulate it, but they don't want to infringe necessarily on private enterprise. And what about people with religious, all of this stuff is coming together and it's forming this. I mean, I hate to sound enthusiastic about it because some of these cases are kind of personally reprehensible, but it's fascinating as students and scholars of American politics, where are the lines, right?
Yeah, I mean, you had the federal case of Heart of Atlanta Hotel versus the United States, where the federal government ruled that, you know, you cannot, just even though you're a private entity, you must fulfill the 64 Civil Rights Act. And so this was a case where they actually used the Commerce Clause of saying, look, this gets in the way of business. And you could actually argue that California's defense of making sure they're not discriminatory is that tourism is a big part of California's industry. Right. And if people are saying, or if people find out that, well, I can't go to certain parts of California, this actually hurts the bottom line. So if you think of all the ads you have come out and visit California, you know, like this is what people in California do. These are all the various things that you can do in California. But then people are being told, like, no, you'll be discriminated against if you go there. Then people don't go.
Yeah.
And so, one, this is the 64 vote, the Civil Rights Act. But then there's also an issue of commerce and that this actually interferes with the ability for the state to properly run and to actually undercut some of its industries.
Right. I mean, you may be asking, it's like, well, if I've got a house and I list it on VRBO, don't I have the right? Let's take it away from racial discrimination, which I think we would all agree is, you know, you can't do that.
Yeah.
But if for religious reasons you wanted not to rent to an atheist or something,
yeah,
right, don't you have the right not to rent your house to somebody? Or if you're vegan and somebody's going to cook, you know, steaks, yeah, there or something, you know, actually that probably would be something you could not do. But what Professor McDaniel is saying is, hey, look, the federal government, you know, in passing the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Heart of Atlanta Hotel is really key, because in that Heart of Atlanta Hotel case, what happened was Heart of Atlanta Hotel said, well, we only cater to people within the state of Georgia. There's no interstate commerce that allows the federal government to regulate us. And what the Supreme Court said was, wait a sec, you've got Heinz beans in your restaurant. Those come from out of state. It is part, your hotel has a stream of commerce such that the federal government does, in fact, have the right to regulate, you know, discriminatory acts because of its power under Article 1 in the Interstate Commerce Clause. So it was, in a lot of ways, sort of fascinating. But here, in an Airbnb case, I think it's pretty clear, you know, yeah, they're probably dealing with, in this case, that around Big Bear, they're mostly dealing with people from LA. But I guarantee you they're getting people from out of state. Yeah. I guarantee you they got products out of state. So Heart of Atlanta Hotel precedent would suggest that, nah, you can't discriminate in terms of who you rent your house out to, right? That you know, it's part of a stream of commerce such that you are subject to federal regulation. In this case, not even federal regulation, although that would come into play, I think. It's the state of California has its own regulations, right? So if you're out there wondering, how is it that the state of the federal government has the right, the constitutional right, you know, to regulate? Well, they do, at least as a matter of sort of decided law.
Yeah, and also you could argue that by not giving this person a place to live, you put them in danger. And the videos showed heavy snowfall. There was no other place to stay. These individuals are now homeless because you basically pulled back on an agreement at the last second because of the race of the individual. There's nothing such as there's a water leak or a gas leak, like some type of emergency, but because really you could argue some type of arbitrary reasoning behind this, which may have put them in greater danger. So there are a variety of ways of trying to kind of justify the state's actions in this. But even Airbnb has been active in putting forth policies saying having anti-discriminatory policies, anti-discrimination policies, because this issue has arisen quite a bit. And so they were trying to get ahead of the curve.
Yeah, we were chuckling. Yeah. We were chuckling before class. We were discussing this. Airbnb had this sort of proud statement that since October 2016, Airbnb has had a non-discriminatory policy.
For the past 10 months.
That's right. They finally got around to formally stating we're not going to discriminate. So kudos to you, Airbnb. By the way, I don't know. I don't want to rag on it. It's not fair of me to say that. It just struck us as a little comical to pat yourself on the back for a non-discrimination statement. But
just like people where the t-shirt said established like 2015. Like, I'm like 100 years from now, that'll be great. But right now, nah, buddy, that ain't helping. Yeah.
And I shouldn't rag on them because, I mean, in fact, they probably thought prior to these sorts of incidents occurring, they didn't need a specific anti-discrimination policy. Don't you just assume that, you know, people are not going to do that kind of stuff? And, you know, if they are going to do that kind of stuff, you can boot them out. But no, you actually need a, you know, an anti-discrimination or non-discrimination policy statement. So I think I'm pretty much done with that story. That's good. We've kept you guys here long enough. We thank you for your patience. Just remember, stay on top of your readings, the web text. If you have specific questions beyond the syllabus, please refer to the syllabus. It's pretty detailed and it'll answer about 99% of your questions. But anything beyond that, please come to Professor McDaniel and I, and we'll get you fixed up. And short of that, we will see you next week.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.